kid. I'm just lucky I didn't get caught. Not that sticking up gas stations is a prank, of course.
That ain't even the half of it. That's just what they nailed us for, he said.
A slight note of bragging had crept into his tone. I'd heard it before, usually from men who longed for the remembered hype of past sports triumphs. I seldom thought of crime as a peak experience, but Tap might. I said, "Listen, if we got nailed for everything we did, we'd all be in jail." He laughed.
"Hey, I like you. I like your attitude."
Daisy brought our beers, and I watched while Tap pulled out a 10.
"Run us a tab," he said to her.
She picked up the bill and moved back toward the register, where I saw her make a note. Meanwhile, Tap studied me, trying to figure out where I was coming from.
"I bet you never robbed nobody at gunpoint."
"No, but my old man did," I said easily. "Did time for it, too." Oh, I liked that. The lie rolled right off my tongue without a moment's thought.
"You're BSing me. Your old man did time? Don't give me that. Where?"
The where came out sounding like were. "Lompoc," I said.
"That's federal," he said. "What'd he do, rob a bank?"
I pointed at him, aiming my finger like a gun.
"God damn," he said. "God damn."
He was excited now, as if he just found out my father was a former president.
"How'd he get caught?"
I shrugged. "He'd been picked up before for passing bad checks, so they just matched the prints on the note he handed the teller. He never even had a chance to spend the money."
"And you never done any time yourself?"
"Not me. I'm a real law and order type."
"That's good. You keep that up. You're too nice to get mixed up with prison types. Women are the worst. Do all kind of things. I've heard tales that'd make your hair stand right up on end, and not the hair on your head, neither."
"I'll bet," I said. I changed the subject, not wanting to lie any more than I had to. "How many kids you got?"
"Here, let me show you,"
he said, reaching in his back pocket. He took out his wallet and flipped it open to a photo tucked in the window where his driver's license should have been.
"That's Jolene."
The woman staring out of the picture looked young and somewhat amazed. Four little children surrounded her, scrubbed, grinning, and shiny-faced. The oldest was a boy, probably 9, snaggle-toothed, his hair still visibly damp where she'd combed it into a pompadour just like his dad's. Two girls came next, probably 6 and 8. A plump-armed baby boy was perched on his mother's lap. The picture had been shot in a studio. The 5 of them posed in the midst of a faux picnic scene, complete with a red-and-white checked cloth and artificial tree branches overhead. The baby held a fake apple in one chubby fist like a bull. "Well, they're cute," I said, hoping he didn't pick up on the note of astonishment.
"They're rascals," he said fondly. "This was last year. She's pregnant again. She's wishing she didn't have to work, but we do pretty good."
"What'd she do?"
"She's a nurse's aide up at community hospital on the orthopedic ward, night shift. She'll work 11 to 7. Then she gets home, and I take off, drop the kids at school, and swing back around to the station. We got a babysitter for the little guy. I don't know quite what we'll do when the new one comes along."
"You'll figure something out," I said.
"My guess," he said.
He flopped the wallet shut and tucked it back in his pocket. I bought a round of beers, and then he bought one. I felt guilty about getting the poor man sloshed, but I had another question or two for him, and I wanted his inhibitions out of the way. Meanwhile, the population in the bar was thinning down from 10 to maybe 6. I noticed with regret that Shanna Timberlake had left. The jukebox had been fixed, and the volume of the music was just loud enough to guarantee privacy, without being so obtrusive we'd be forced to shout. I was relaxed, but not as loose as I allowed Tap to think. I gave his arm a bump. "Tell me something," I said soddenly. "I'm just curious."
"What's that?"
"How much money did you and this Bailey fellow net?"
"Net?"
"In round numbers. About how much you make. I'm just asking. You don't have to say."
"We paid restitution on $2,000-some-odd.
$2,000?
"Bull, you made more than that," I said.
Tap flushed with pleasure.
"You think so?"
"Even bumping off gas stations, you made more, I bet."
"That's all I ever saw," he said. That's all they caught you for, I said, correcting him.
That's all I put in my pocket, and that's the honest truth.
But how much else? How much altogether?
Tap studied up on that one, extending his chin, pulling at his lip in a parody of deep thought.
In the neighborhood, I would say of, would you believe, 42,606.
Who got that? Bailey got that?
Oh, it's gone now. He never did see a dime of it neither, as far as I know.
Where'd it come from?
Couple little jobs we pulled they never found out about.
I laughed with delight.
Well, you old devil, you, I said, and gave his arm another push. Where'd it go?
Beats me.
I laughed again, and he got tickled, too. Somehow it seemed like the funniest thing either of us ever heard. After half a minute, the laughter trickled out, and Tap shook his head.
Whoa, that's good, he said. I haven't laughed like that since I don't know when.
You think Bailey killed that little girl?
Don't know, he said, but I will tell you this. When we went off to jail, we give the money to Jean Timberlake to hold. He got out, and next thing I know, she's dead, and he says he don't know where the money's at. It was long gone.
Why didn't you get it when the two of you got out?
Ah, no, The cops probably had their eye on us, waiting to see if we'd make a move. God damn, everybody figured he killed her for sure. Me, I don't know. Doesn't seem like him. Then again, she might have spent all the money and he choked her in a fit.
No, I don't believe that. I thought Pearl said she was knocked up.
Well, she was, but Bailey wouldn't kill her for that. What's the point? The money's all we cared about, and why in hell not? We done jail time. We paid. We get out, and we're too smart to start throwing cash around. We laid low. After she died, Bailey told me she was the only one knew for sure where it was, and she never told. He didn't want to know in case he ever had to take a lie detector test. Gone for good by now. Or maybe it's still hid, only nobody knows where.
Maybe he has it after all. Maybe that's what he's lived on the whole time he's been gone.
I don't know. I doubt it, but I'd sure like to have me a little talk with him.
What do you think, though? Honestly.
The honest truth?
He said, fixing me with a look. He leaned closer, winking.
I think I gotta go see a man about a dog. Don't go away now.
He eased off the stool. He turned and pointed a finger at me solemnly like a gun. I fired a digit right back at him. He proceeded to the John, walking with the exaggerated nonchalance of a man who's drunk. I waited 15 minutes, nursing my beer, with an occasional glance at the door to the unisex facility. The woman who'd been dancing with Shanna Timberlake was now playing pool with a kid who looked 18. It was nearly midnight by then, and Daisy started cleaning off the bar with a rag. "Where'd Tap go?" I said, when she had worked her way down within range of me.
"He got a phone call and took off."
"Just now?"
"A few minutes ago. He still owes a couple bucks on that tab."
"I'll take care of it," I said. I laid a 5 on the bar and waved away any change. She was looking at me.
"You know, Tap's the biggest bullshitter ever lived."
I gathered as much. Her gaze was dark.
"He might have been in trouble some years ago, but these days he's a decent family man. Nice wife and kids."
"Why tell me? I'm not hustling his buns."
"Why all the questions about the Fowler boy? You've been pumping him all night."
"I talked to Royce. I'm curious about this business with his son, that's all."
"What's it to you?"
"It's just something to jaw about. There's nothing else going on." She seemed to soften, apparently satisfied at the benevolence of my intent.
"You here on vacation?"
"Business," I replied. I thought she'd pursue it, but she let the subject drop.
"We close about this time weeknights," she said. "You're welcome to stay while I lock up in back, but Pearl doesn't like anyone around when I close out the register."
I realized then that I was the last person in the place.
"I guess I better let you get on with it, then. I've had enough, anyway."
The fog had curled right up to the road, obscuring the beach in a bunting of yellow mist. In the distance, a foghorn repeated its warning note. There were no cars passing and no sign of anyone on foot. Behind me, Daisy flipped the deadbolt and turned off the exterior lights, leaving me on my own. I walked briskly back to my motel room, wondering why Tap hadn't said goodbye. Chapter 8. Bailey's arraignment was scheduled for Room B of the Municipal Court, on the lower level of the San Luis Obispo County Courthouse on Monterey Street. Royce rode with me. He didn't really seem well enough for the trip into town, but he was determined to have his way. Since Anne was taking her mother to the doctor that morning and couldn't accompany us, we tried to minimize the exertions he'd be subjected to. I dropped him out in front, watching as he made his way painfully up the wide concrete steps. We had arranged for him to wait for me in the airy lobby coffee shop, with its skylights and potted ficus plants. I had already briefed him in the car coming over, and he'd seemed satisfied with the state of my inquiries to that point. Now I wanted the opportunity to bring Jack Clemson up to speed. I left my car parked in a small private lot behind the attorney's office a block away. Clemson and I walked over to the courthouse together, using the time to talk about Bailey's frame of mind, which he found worrisome. With me, Bailey had seemed to alternate between numbness and despair. By the time he and Clemson chatted later in the day, his mood had darkened considerably. He was convinced he was never going to beat the escape charge. He was certain he'd end up at the men's colony again, and equally certain he'd never survive incarceration.
"The guy's a basket case," Jack said. "I can't seem to talk any sense into him."
"But what are his chances, realistically?"
"Hey, I'm doing what I can. Bail's been set at $500,000, which is ridiculous. We're not talking Jack the Ripper here. I'll enter a motion to reduce, and maybe I can talk the prosecuting attorney into letting him plead to escape for the minimum. The time will be added on, of course, but there's no way around that."
"And if I come up with some convincing evidence that someone else killed Gene Timberlake?"
"Then I'd move to set aside the original plea, or maybe file a coram nobis. Either way, we'd be set."
"Don't count on it, but I'll do what I can." He flashed a smile at me, holding up crossed fingers. When we got to the courthouse, he left me in the lobby, while he went down to meet with the prosecuting attorney and the judge in chambers. The coffee shop was really no more than a wide expanse of central lobby, jammed with people now, the press in evidence. Royce was seated at a small table near the stairs, his hands folded across the top of his cane. He seemed tired. His hair had that matted, slightly sweaty cast of someone in ill health. He had ordered coffee, but it sat in the cup looking cold and untouched. I took a seat. The waitress swung by with a fresh pot of coffee, but I shook my head. Royce's anxiety enveloped the table like a sour, hopeless scent. He was clearly a proud man, accustomed to bending the world to his will. Bailey's arraignment already bore all the trappings of a public spectacle. The local paper had been running the story of his capture on the front page for days, and the local radio stations made mention of it at the top of each hour and again in the quick news summaries on the half hour. A crew with a minicam passed just to the right of us, heading down the stairs without realizing Bailey Fowler's father was sitting within camera range. He turned a baleful eye on them, and the ensuing smile was bitter in grief.
"Maybe we better go on down," I said.
We descended the stairs, walking slowly. I controlled an urge to give him physical support, sensing that he might take offense. His stoicism had a hint of self-mockery to it. He was grimly amused to have prevailed thus far, forcing his body to do his bidding regardless of the cost. The corridor below was lined on one side with big plate glass windows, with two exits into a sunken courtyard. Both the interior passageway and the exterior stairways were filling with spectators, some of whom seemed to recognize Royce as we passed. There was a silent parting in the crowd, gazes averted as we made our way into the courtroom. In the third row, people squeezed together to make room for us. There was the same hushed murmuring as in a church before services start. Most had dressed in their Sunday best, and the air seemed to stir with conflicting perfumes. No one spoke to Royce, but I could sense the rustling and nudging going on all around us. If he was humbled by the reaction, he gave no sign. He had been a respected member of the community, but Bailey's notoriety had tainted him. To have a son accused of murder is the same as being accused of a crime oneself. Parental failure of the direst sort. Unfair though it may be, there is always that unspoken question. What did these people do to turn this once innocent child into a cold-blooded killer of another human being? I had checked the docket posted in the upstairs corridor. There were 10 other arraignments scheduled that morning in addition to Bailey's. The door to the judge's chambers was closed. The court clerk, a slim, handsome woman in a navy blue suit, was seated at a table below and to the right of the judge's bench. The court reporter, also female, sat at a matching table to the left. There were a dozen attorneys present, most in dark, conservatively cut suits, all with white shirts, muted ties, black shoes. Only one was female. While we waited for the proceedings to begin, I scanned the crowd. Shanna Timberlake was seated across the aisle from us, one row back. Under the flat fluorescent lights, the illusion of youth vanished, and I could see the dark streaks at the corners of her eyes, suggesting age, weariness, too many nights in bad company. She was wide-shouldered, heavy-breasted, slender through the waist and hips, wearing jeans and a flannel shirt. As mother of the victim, she was free to dress any way she liked. Her hair was nearly black, with a few strands of silver here and there, combed straight back from her face and held with a clip on top. She turned her hot, dark eyes on me, and I looked away. She knew I was with Royce. When I glanced back, I could see her gaze lingering on him with a blunt appraisal of his physical condition. One other woman caught my attention as she came down the aisle. She was in her early 30s, sallow, thin, wearing an apricot-knit dress with a big stain across the hem. She had on a white sweater and white heels with short white cotton socks. Her hair was a dishwater blonde, held back with a wide, tatty-looking headband. She was accompanied by a man I assumed was her husband. He appeared to be in his mid-30s, with curly blonde hair and the sort of pouty good looks I've never liked. Pearl was with them, and I wondered if this was the son he'd referred to, who had seen Bailey with Jean Timberlake the night she was killed. There was a faint escalation of murmurs at the rear of the courtroom, and I turned my head. The crowd's attention focused in the way it does at a wedding when the bride appears, ready to begin her walk down the aisle. The prisoners were being brought in, and the sight was oddly disturbing. 9 men, handcuffed, shackled together, shuffling forward with their leg chains. They wore jail garb, unconstructed cotton shirts in orange, light gray or charcoal, and gray or pale blue cotton pants with jail stenciled across the butt, white cotton socks, the type of plastic sandals known as jellies. Most of them were young, 5 Latinos and 3 black guys. Bailey was the only white. He seemed acutely self-conscious, high color in his cheeks, his eyes downcast, the modest star of this chorus line of thugs. His fellow prisoners seemed to take the proceedings for granted, nodding to the scattering of friends and relatives. Most of the spectators had come to see Bailey Fowler, but nobody seemed to begrudge him his status. A uniformed deputy escorted the men into the jury box up front, where their leg chains were removed in case one of them had to approach the bench. The prisoners settled in, like the rest of us, to enjoy the show. The bailiff went through his "All Rise" recital, and we dutifully rose as the judge appeared and took his seat. Judge McMahon was in his 40s and bristled with efficiency. Trim and fair-haired, he looked like the kind of man who played handball and squash and risked dropping dead of a heart attack despite his prior history of perfect health. Bailey's case was being called next to last, so we were treated to a number of minor procedural dramas. A translator had to be summoned from somewhere in the building to aid in the arraignments of 2 of the accused who spoke no English. Papers had been misfiled. 2 cases were kicked over to another date. Another set of papers had been sent but never received, and the judge was irked about that because the attorney had no proof of service and the other side wasn't ready. 2 additional defendants out on O.R. were seated in the audience, and each stepped forward in turn as his case was called. At one point, one of the deputies pulled out a set of keys and unlocked an accused's handcuffs so that he could talk to his attorney at the back of the room. While that conference was going on, another prisoner engaged the judge in a lengthy discussion, insistent on representing himself. Judge McMahon was very opposed to the idea and spent 10 minutes warning and admonishing, advising and scolding. The defendant refused to budge. The judge was finally forced to concede to the fellow's wishes since it was his right, but he was clearly cross about the matter. Through all of this, an undercurrent of restlessness was agitating the spectators into side conversations and titters of laughter. They were primed for the lead act, And here they were, having to suffer through this second-rate series of burglaries and sexual assault cases. I half expected them to start clapping in unison, like a movie audience when the film is delayed. Jack Clemson had been leaning against the wall in murmured conversation with the attorney next to him. As the time approached for Bailey's case to be called, he broke away and crossed the room. He spoke to the deputy, and she unlocked Bailey's handcuffs. The two of them had just stepped to one side when there was a shout from the back. The judge's head snapped up, and everybody turned simultaneously. A man in a red ski mask stood in the doorway, brandishing a sawed-off shotgun. The effect was electric, a ripple running through the room.
"Freeze!" he yelled. "Everybody just hold it right there!"
He fired once, apparently to make his point. The boom from the gun was deafening, and the blast took one of the overhead lights right off its chain and sent it crashing to the floor. Shattered glass rained down like a cloudburst, and people screamed and scrambled for cover. A baby started shrieking. Everybody hit the floor, including me. Bailey's father was still sitting upright, immobilized by surprise. I reached up and grabbed him by the shirt front. I pulled him down to the floor with me, sheltering him with my body weight. He struggled, trying to get up, but in his condition it didn't take much to subdue him. I glanced over in time to see one of the deputies belly crawl up the aisle to my right, shielded from the gunman's view by the wooden benches. I'd caught a glimpse of the gunman, and I could have sworn it was Tap, his hands shaking badly. He seemed too small to be a threat, his entire body tensed by fear. The true menace was the shotgun, with its broad, lethal spray, the indiscriminate destruction if his finger slipped. Any unexpected movement might startle him into firing. Two women on the other side of Royce were burbling hysterically, clinging to one another like lovers.
"Bailey, come on! Get the fuck out of here!"
the gunman screamed. His voice broke from fright, and I felt a chill as I peered over the seat. It had to be Tap. Bailey was transfixed. He stared in disbelief, and then he was in motion. He leaped the wooden railing and ran, pounding down the aisle toward the rear door while Tap blasted again. A large framed photograph of the governor jumped off the wall, disintegrating as the pellets ripped through glass, wood frame, and matting in a spray of white. A second round of wails and screams erupted from the crowd. Bailey had disappeared by then. Tap cracked the shotgun and jammed in two more shells as he backed out of the courtroom. I heard running. An outside door slammed, and then there were shouts and the sound of shots. In the courtroom there was chaos. The clerk and the court reporter were nowhere to be seen, and I could only guess that the judge had made his way out of the room at floor level, crawling on his hands and knees. Once the immediate threat was gone, people surged forward in a panic, shoving toward the bench, pushing through to the safety of the judge's chambers beyond. Pearl was hustling his son and daughter-in-law out the fire exit, setting off an alarm bell that clanged at a piercing pitch. More screams sounded from the corridor, where someone was shouting incomprehensibly. I headed in that direction, bent double, until I could get a sense of what was happening. If more gunfire broke out, I didn't want to get caught by flying bullets. I passed a woman bleeding badly from the glass shards that had cut into her face. Someone was already applying pressure to the worst of her wounds, while beside her, two little children huddled together and wept. I reached the rear door and pushed out. Shanna Timberlake was leaning against the wall to my left, her face blanched, the shadows under her eyes as emphatic as stage makeup. Outside, police sirens were already spiraling against the morning air. Through the big plate glass walls that formed one side of the corridor, I could see uniformed police officers spilling down the steps into the courtyard outside. Several women screamed in continuous shrill tones, as if the shooting had unleashed years of suppressed anguish. The jam of hysterical people in the hallway surged forward and then parted abruptly. Tap Granger lay on his back, his arms flung out like he was taking a sunbath. The red ski mask had been pulled back off his face, and it rested on the back of his head as flabby as a rooster's crest. He wore a short-sleeved shirt, and I could see where his wife had ironed the creases in it. His arms looked skinny. His whole body looked dead. Bailey was nowhere in sight. I went back into the courtroom, aware for the first time that I was crunching my way through broken glass and grit. Royce Fowler was on his feet, swaying uncertainly among the rows of empty benches. His mouth trembled.
"Tell me you had nothing to do with this," I said to him. "Where's Bailey? Where's my boy? They'll shoot him down like a dog.
No, they won't. He's unarmed. They'll find him. I take it you didn't know this was going to happen?
Who was that in the mask?
Tap Granger. He's dead.
Roy sank onto the bench and lowered his head into his hands. The debris underfoot made a crackling sound. Looking down, I realized the floor was littered with white specks. I stared in confusion, then bent down and picked up a handful.
What is this? I said.
Comprehension came in the same moment, but it still made no sense. Tap's shotgun shells had been loaded with rock salt.
Chapter 9. By the time we got back to the motel, Royce was close to collapse, and I had to let him into bed. Anne and Dory had heard the news in the doctor's office, and they came straight home, pulling in soon after I did. Bailey Fowler was being billed as a killer on the loose, believed armed and dangerous. The streets of Floral Beach already looked deserted, as if in the wake of some natural disaster. I could practically hear the doors slamming all up and down the block. Little children jerked to safety, old ladies peering out from behind their curtains. Why anyone thought Bailey would be foolish enough to come back to his parents' house, I don't know. The sheriff's department must have considered it a good possibility, because a deputy in a tan uniform stopped by the motel and had a long, officious chat with Anne, one hand on his gun butt, his gaze shifting from point to point, searching, I assumed, for some indication that the escapee was being harbored on the premises. As soon as the patrol car pulled away, friends began to arrive with solemn expressions, dropping off casseroles. Some of these people I'd seen at the courthouse, and I couldn't tell if their appearance was motivated by sympathy or a craven desire to be part of the continuing drama. Two neighbor ladies came, introduced to me as Mrs. Emma and Mrs. Maud, aging sisters who'd known Bailey since he was a boy. Robert Hawes, the minister from the Baptist Church, appeared along with his wife, June, and yet another woman who introduced herself as Mrs. Burke, the owner of the laundromat two blocks away. She just popped over for a minute, she said, to see if there was anything she could do. I was hoping she'd offer cut rates on the fluff and fold, but apparently this didn't occur to her. Judging from Mrs. Maud's expression, she disapproved of the store-bought frozen cheesecake the laundromat lady handed over so blithely. Mrs. Maud and Mrs. Emma exchanged a look that suggested this was not the first time Mrs. Burke had flaunted her lack of culinary zealousness. The phone rang incessantly. Mrs. Emma appointed herself the telephone receptionist, fielding calls, keeping a log of names and return numbers in case Ori felt up to it later. Royce refused to see anyone, but Ori entertained from her bed, repeating endlessly the circumstances under which she'd heard the news, what she'd first thought, when the facts had finally penetrated, and how she'd commenced to howl with misery until the doctor sedated her. Whatever Tap Granger's fate or her son's fugitive status, she experienced events as peripheral to the Ori Fowler show, in which she starred. Before I had a chance to slip out of the room, the minister asked us to join him in a word of prayer. I have to confess, I've never been taught proper prayer etiquette. As far as I can tell, it consists of folded hands, solemnly bowed heads, and no peeking at the other supplicants. I don't object to religious practices per se. I'm just not crazy about having someone else inflict their beliefs on me. Whenever Jehovah's Witnesses appear at my door, I always ask for their addresses first thing, assuring them that I'll be around later in the week to plague them with my views. While the minister interceded with the Lord in Bailey Fowler's behalf, I absented myself mentally, using the time to study his wife. June Hawes was in her 50s, no more than 5 feet tall, and, like many women in her weight class, destined for a sedentary life. Naked, she was probably dead white and dimpled with fat. She wore white cotton gloves with some sort of amber-staining ointment visible at the wrist. With her face blocked out, hers were the kind of limbs one might see in a medical journal, illustrative of particularly scabrous outbreaks of impetigo and eczema. When Reverend Hawes's interminable prayer had come to a close, Anne excused herself and went into the kitchen. It was clear that the appearance of servitude on her part was actually a means of escaping whenever she could. I followed her, and in the guise of being helpful, began to set out cups and saucers, arranging Pepperidge Farm cookies on plates lined with paper doilies while she hauled out the big stainless steel coffee urn that usually sat in the office. On the kitchen counter, I could see a tuna casserole with crushed potato chips on top, a ground beef and noodle bake, and two jello molds, one cherry with fruit cocktail, one lime with grated carrots, which Anne asked me to refrigerate. It had only been an hour and a half since Bailey fled the courthouse in a blaze of gunfire. I didn't think gelatin set up that fast, but these Christian ladies probably knew tricks with ice cubes that would render salads and desserts in record time for just such occasions. I pictured a section in the Ladies' Auxiliary Church cookbook for sudden-death quick snacks, using ingredients one could keep on the pantry shelf in the event of tragedy.
"What can I do to help?"
June Hawes asked from the kitchen door. With her cotton gloves, she looked like a pallbearer, possibly for someone who had died recently from the same skin disease. I moved a plate of cookies just out of range and pulled a chair out so she could have a seat.
"Oh, not for me, hun," she said. "I never sit. Why don't you let me take over, Anne, and you can get off your feet?"
"We're doing fine," Anne said. "If you can keep Mother's mind off Bailey, that's all the help we need."
"Hawes is reading scriptures with her even as we speak. I can't believe what that woman's been through. It's enough to break your heart. How's your daddy doing? Is he all right?" "Well, it's been a shock, of course." "Of course it has. That poor man," she looked over at me. "I'm June Hawes. I don't believe we've been introduced,"
Anne broke in.
"I'm sorry, June. This is Kinsey Milhone. She's a private detective Pop hired to help us out."
"Private detective," she said with disbelief. "I didn't think there was such a thing, except on television shows."
"Nice to meet you," I said. "I'm afraid the work we do isn't quite that thrilling."
"Well, I hope not. All those gun battles and car chases, it's enough to make my blood run cold. It doesn't seem like a fit occupation for a nice girl like you."
"I'm not that nice," I said modestly. She laughed, mistaking this for a joke. I avoided any further interaction by picking up a cookie plate.
"Let me just take these on in," I murmured, moving toward the other room.
Once in the hallway, I slowed my pace, caught between Bible readings in the one room and relentless platitudes in the other. I hesitated in the doorway. The high school principal, Dwight Shales, had appeared while I was gone, but he was deep in conversation with Mrs. Emma and didn't seem to notice me. I eased into the living room, where I handed the cookie plate to Mrs. Maud, then excused myself again and headed toward the office. Reverend Hawes was intoning an alarming passage from the Old Testament, full of besiegedness, pestilence, consuming locusts, and distress. Ori's lot must have seemed pretty tame by comparison, which was probably the point. I went up to my room. It was almost noon, and my guess was the assembled would hang around for a hot lunch. With luck, I could slip down the outside stairs and reach my car before anybody realized I was gone. I washed my face and ran a comb through my hair. I had my jacket over my arms and a hand on the doorknob when somebody knocked. For a moment I flashed on the image of Dwight Shales. Maybe he'd gotten the okay to talk to me. I opened the door. Reverend Hawes was standing in the corridor.
"I hope you don't mind," he said. "Anne thought you'd probably come up here to your room. I didn't have an opportunity to introduce myself. I'm Robert Hawes of the Floral Beach Baptist Church."
"Hi, how are you?"
"I'm just fine. My wife June was telling me what a nice chat she had with you a short while ago. She suggested you might like to join us for Bible study over at the church tonight."
"How nice," I said. "Actually, I'm not sure where I'll be tonight, but I appreciate the invitation." I'm embarrassed to admit it, but I was mimicking the warm, folksy tone they all used with one another. Like his wife, Reverend Hawes appeared to be in his 50s, but aging better than she was, I thought. He was round-faced, handsome in a goody-two-shoes sort of way, bifocals with wire frames, sandy hair streaked with gray, cut full, with just the faintest suggestion of styling mousse. He was wearing a business suit and a muted Glen plaid, and a black shirt with a clerical collar that seemed an affectation for a Protestant. I didn't think Baptists wore things like that. He had all the easy charm of someone who spent his entire adult life on the receiving end of pious compliments. We shook hands. He held on to mine and gave it a pat, making lots of Christian eye contact.
I understand you're from Santa Teresa. I wonder if you know Millard Alston from the Baptist Church there in Colgate. He and I were seminarians together. I hate to tell you how long ago that's been.
I extracted my hand from his moist grip, smiling pleasantly. The name doesn't sound familiar. Of course, I don't have much occasion to be out in that direction.
What's your congregation? I hope you're not going to tell me you're an ornery Methodist.
He said this with a laugh, just to show what a wacky sense of humor he had.
Not at all, I said.
He peered toward the room behind me.
Your husband traveling with you?
No, actually he's not. I glanced at my watch.
Oh, golly, I'm late.
The golly rather stuck in my throat, but it didn't seem to bother him. He put his hands in his pants pockets, subtly adjusting himself.
I hate to see you run off so soon. If you're in Floral Beach come Sunday, maybe you can make it to the 11 o'clock service and then join us for lunch. June doesn't cook any more because of her condition, but we'd enjoy having you as our guest at the Apple Farm restaurant.
Oh, gee, I wish I could, but I'm not sure I'll be here for the weekend. Maybe another time.
Well, you're a tough little gal to pin down, he said.
His manner was a trifle irritated, and I had to guess he was unaccustomed to having his unctuous overtures rebuffed.
I sure am, I said.
I put on my jacket as I moved out into the corridor. Reverend Hawes stepped aside, but he was still standing closer to me than I would have liked. I pulled the door shut behind me, making sure it was locked. I walked toward the stairs, and he followed me.
Sorry to be in such a rush, but I have an appointment.
I'd cut the warm, folksy tone to a minimum.
I'll let you get on your way, then.
The last I saw of him, he was standing at the head of the exterior stairs, looking down at me with a chilly gaze that contradicted his surface benevolence. I started my car, and then waited in the parking slot until I'd seen him walk by, returning to the Fowlers. I didn't like the idea of his being anywhere near my room if I was off the premises. I drove half a mile along the two-lane access road that connected Floral Beach to the highway, another mile due north. I reached the entrance to the Eucalyptus Mineral Hot Springs and turned into the parking lot. The brochure in the motel office indicated that the sulfur-based springs had been discovered in the late 1800s by two men drilling for oil. Instead of the intended rigs, a spa was built, serving as a therapeutic center for ailing Californians who arrived by train, alighting at the tiny station just across the road. A staff of doctors and nurses attended the afflicted, offering cures that included mud baths, nostrums, herbal treatments, and hydroelectric therapy. The facility flourished briefly and then fell into disuse until the 1930s, when the present hotel was constructed on the site. A second incarnation occurred in the early 70s when spas became fashionable again. Now, in addition to the 50 or so hot tubs that dotted the hillside under the oak and eucalyptus trees, there were tennis courts, a heated pool, and aerobics classes available, along with a full program of facials, massage, yoga instruction, and nutritional counseling. The hotel itself was a two-story affair, a curious testament to 30s architecture, Art Deco Spanish, complete with turrets, sensuously rounded corners, and walls of block glass. I approached the office by way of a covered walk, the air chilled by deep shade, unrelieved by sunlight. At close range, the building's stucco exterior showed bulging cracks that snaked up from the foundations to the terracotta roof tiles that had aged to the color of cinnamon. The sulfurous aroma of the mineral springs blended dankly with the smell of wet leaves. There was the suggestion of subtle leakages, something permeating the soil, and I wondered if, later, drums of poisonous wastes would be excavated from the spot. I took a quick detour, climbing a set of steep wooden stairs that cut up along the hill behind the hotel. There were gazebos at intervals, each sheltering a hot tub sunk into a wooden platform. Weathered wooden fences were strategically placed to shield the bathers from public view. Each alcove had a name, perhaps to facilitate some scheduling procedure in the office down below. I passed Serenity, Meditation, Sunset, and Peace, uncomfortably aware of how similar the names were to the sleep rooms in certain funeral homes of my acquaintance. Two of the tubs were empty, littered with fallen leaves. One had an opaque plastic cover lying on the surface of the water like a skin. I picked my way down the steps again, thankful that I wasn't in the market for a hot soak. At the main building, I pushed through glass doors into the reception area. The lobby seemed more inviting, but it still had the feel of a YWCA in need of funds. The floors were a mosaic of black and white tiles, the smell of pine sol suggesting a recent swabbing with a wet mop. From the far reaches of the interior, I could hear the hollow echoes of an indoor pool, where a woman with a German accent called out authoritatively, "Kick, resist! Kick, resist!" Her commands were punctuated by a torpid splashing that called to mind the clumsy mating of water buffalo.
"May I help you?"
The receptionist had emerged from a small office behind me. She was tall, big-boned, one of those women who probably shopped in the full-figured department of women's clothing stores. She must have been in her late 40s, with white blonde hair, white lashes, and pale, unblemished skin. Her hands and feet were large, and the shoes she wore were the prison matron lace-up sort. I handed her my business card, introducing myself.
"I'm looking for someone who might remember Jean Timberlake."
She kept her eyes pinned on my face, her expression blank.
"You'll want to talk to my husband, Dr. Dunn. Unfortunately, he's away."
"Can you tell me when he's expected back?"
"I'm not certain. If you leave a number, I can have him call when he returns."
We locked eyes. Hers were the stony gray of winter skies before snow.
"What about you?" I said. "Did you know the girl yourself?"
There was a pause, then carefully,
"I knew who she was.
I understand she was working here at the time of her death."
"I don't think this is something we should discuss," she glanced down at the card. "Miss Milhone."
"Is there some problem?"
"If you'll tell me how to reach you, I'll have my husband get in touch."
"Room 22 at the Ocean Street Motel, and I know where it is. I'm sure he'll call if he has time."
"Wonderful. That way we won't have to bother about subpoenas."
I was bluffing, of course, and she might have guessed as much, but I did enjoy the pale wash of color that suffused her cheeks.
"I'll check back if I don't hear from him," I said.
It wasn't until I reached the car again that I remembered the owners mentioned in the brochure I'd seen. Dr. and Mrs. Joseph Dunn had bought the hotel the same year Jean Timberlake died.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.
Chapter 10. It was 12:35 when I swung back around to the main street of Floral Beach and parked my car out in front of Pearl's Pool Hall. Weekday business hours were listed as 11 o'clock a.m. to 2 o'clock a.m. The door stood open. Last night's air tumbled out in a sluggish breeze that smelled of beer spills and cigarettes. The interior was stuffy, slightly warmer than the ocean-chilled temperature outside. I caught sight of Daisy at the back door, hauling out a massive plastic sack of trash. She gave me a noncommittal look, but I sensed that her mood was dark. I took a seat at the bar. I was the only customer at that hour. Empty, the place seemed even more drab than it had the night before. The floors had been swept, and I could see peanut shells and cigarette butts in a heap near the broom, waiting to be nudged into the dustpan propped nearby. The back door banged shut, and Daisy reappeared, wiping her hands on the toweling she tucked in her belt. She approached warily, her gaze not quite meeting mine.
"How's the detective work?"
"I'm sorry I didn't identify myself last night."
"What's it to me? I don't give a damn who you are."
"Maybe not, but I wasn't quite straight with Tap, and I feel bad about that."
"You look real tore up."
I shrugged. "I know it sounds lame, but it's the truth. You thought I was hustling him, and in a way I was." She said nothing. She stood and stared at me. After a while she said, "You want a Coca-Cola? I'm having one." I nodded, watching as she picked up a couple of mason jars and filled them from the hose dispenser under the bar. She set mine in front of me.
"Thanks."
"I hear by the grapevine Royce hired you," she said. "What did he do that for?"
"He's hoping to have Bailey cleared of the murder charge."
"He'll have a hell of a time after what happened this morning. If Bailey's innocent like he claims, why take off?"
"People get impulsive under pressure. When I talked to him at the jail, he seemed pretty desperate. Maybe when Tap showed up, he saw a way out."
Daisy's tone was contemptuous. Kid never did have a lick of sense, so it would seem.
What about Royce? How's he doing?
Not that well. He went right to bed. A lot of people are over there with Ori.
I don't have much use for her, Daisy said. Anybody heard from Bailey?
Not as far as I know. She busied herself behind the bar, running a sink full of hot soapy water and a second sink full of rinse water. She began to wash mason jars left over from the night before, her motions automatic as she ran through the sequence, setting clean jars to drain on a towel to the right.
What did you want with Tap?
I was curious what he had to say about Gene Timberlake.
I heard you asking him about the stick-ups them two pulled.
I was interested in whether his version would match Bailey's.
Did it?
More or less, I said. I studied her as she worked, wondering why she was suddenly so interested. I wasn't about to mention the $42,000 Tap claimed had disappeared.
Who called him here last night? Did you recognize the voice?
Some man. Not anyone I knew right off. Might have been someone I'd talked to before, but I couldn't say for sure.
There was something queer about the whole conversation, she remarked.
You think it was related to the shooting?
It almost had to be.
That's what I think, too, the way he tore out of here. I'd be willing to swear it wasn't Bailey, though.
Probably not, I said. He wouldn't have been permitted to use the jail phone at that hour, and he couldn't have met with Tap in any event.
What made the call seem so queer?
Odd voice, deep, and the speech was kind of drug out, like someone who'd had a stroke.
Like a speech impediment?
Maybe. I'd have to think about that some. I can't quite put my finger on it.
She was silent for a moment and then shook her head, shifting the subject.
Tap's wife, Jolene, is who I feel sorry for. Have you talked to her?
Not yet. I guess I will at some point.
Four little kids, another due any day?
Nasty business. I wish he'd used his head. There's no way he could have pulled it off. The deputies are always armed.
He never had a chance, I said.
Maybe that's the way they wanted it.
Who?
Whoever put him up to it.
I knew Tap since he was 10 years old. Believe me, he wasn't smart enough to come up with a scheme like that on his own.
I looked at her with interest.
Good point, I said. Maybe Bailey was meant to get whacked at the same time, thus eliminating both of them.
I reached into my jeans pocket and pulled out the list of Gene Timberlake's classmates.
Any of these guys still around?
She took the list, pausing while she removed a pair of bifocals from her shirt pocket. She hooked the stems across her ears. She held the paper at arm's length and peered at the names, tilting her head back.
This one's dead. Ran his car off the road about 10 years ago.
This fella moved up to Santa Cruz, last I heard.
The rest are either here in Floral Beach or San Luis.
You going to talk to every one of them?
If I have to.
David Paletti's a dentist with an office on Marsh. You might want to start with him.
Nice man. I've known his mother for years.
Was he a friend of Jean's?
I doubt it, but he'd probably know who was.
As it turned out, David Paletti was a children's dentist who spent Wednesday afternoons in the office catching up on his paperwork. I waited briefly in a pastel-painted reception suite with scaled-down furniture and tattered issues of Highlights for Children stacked on low tables, along with Jack and Jill and Young Miss. Of special interest to me in the last was a column called Was My Face Red?, in which young girls gushingly related embarrassing moments, most of which were things I'd done not that long ago. Knocking a full cup of Coke off a balcony railing was one. The people down below really yell, don't they? Dr. Paletti's office staff was composed of three women in their 20s, Alice in Wonderland types with big eyes, sweet smiles, long straight hair, and nothing threatening about them. Soothing music oozed out of the walls like whiffs of nitrous oxide. By the time I was ushered into his inner office, I would almost have been willing to sit in a tot-sized dental chaise and have my gums probed with one of those tiny stainless steel pruning hooks. When I shook hands with Dr. Paletti, he was still wearing a white jacket with an alarming blood stain on the front. He caught sight of it about the same time I did and peeled his jacket off, tossing it across a chair with a soft, apologetic smile. Under the jacket, he was wearing a dress shirt and a sweater vest. He indicated that I should take a seat while he shrugged into a brown tweed sport coat and adjusted his cuffs. He was maybe 35, tall with a narrow face, his hair frizzed in tight curls already turning gray along the sides. I knew from his yearbook pictures that he'd played high school basketball, and I imagined sophomore girls gushing over him in the cafeteria. He wasn't technically handsome, but he had a certain appeal, a gentleness in his demeanor that must have been reassuring to women and little kids. His eyes were small and drooped slightly at the corners, the color a mild brown behind lightweight metallic frames. He sat down at his desk. A color studio portrait of his wife and two young boys was prominently displayed, probably to dispel any fantasies his staff might entertain about his availability.
"Tawna says you have some questions about an old high school classmate. Given recent events, I'm assuming it's Jean Timberlake."
"How well did you know her?"
"Not very well. I knew who she was, but I don't think I ever had a class with her."
He reached for a set of Plaster of Paris impressions that sat on his desk, upper plate positioned above the lower in a jutting overbite. He cleared his throat.
"What sort of information are you looking for?"
"Whatever you can tell me. Bailey Fowler's father hired me to see if I could come up with some new evidence. I thought I'd start with Jean and work forward from there."
"Why come to me?"
I told him about my conversation with Daisy and her suggestion that he might be of help. His manner seemed to shift, becoming less suspicious, though a certain wariness remained. Idly he lifted the mold's upper plate and stuck his finger in, feeling the crowded lower incisors. If I had banged a fist down on the mold, I could have bitten his finger off. The thought made it hard to concentrate on what he was saying.
"I've been thinking a lot about the murder since Bailey Fowler's arrest. Terrible thing, just terrible."
"Were you in that group of kids who found her, by any chance?"
"No, no, I'm a Catholic. That was the youth group from the Baptist church."
"The one in Floral Beach?" He nodded, and I made a mental note, thinking of Reverend Hawes. "I've heard she was a bit free with her favors," I said.
"That's the reputation she had. Some of my patients are young girls her age, 14, 15. They just seem so immature. I can't imagine them sexually active. And yet I'm sure some of them are."
"I've seen pictures of Jean. She was a beautiful girl."
"Not in any way that served her. She wasn't like the rest of us. Too old in some ways, innocent in others. I guess she thought she'd be popular if she put out, so that's what she did. A lot of guys took advantage.